The meaning of dandelions. From The Secret Language of Plants. By Andrina. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 2. The Second Year. In retrospect, perhaps Harry should have kept Hedwig with him. He didn't know. On the one hand, if he'd had Hedwig, he could send a letter to someone asking for help. On the other, he wasn't sure that they would answer. Harry's expectations of adults were very low. Well, Ron would. Ron and Hermione, they would definitely help. The situation wasn't terrible. Harry read a bit of Dumas and Salgari, not as much as he would have liked to, because the library at Hogwarts was dreadful and had all the wrong kinds of books. And he knew you could barely call it imprisonment if there were no shackles and a pallet with a straw mattress. Harry had a room, a proper one at that, without a slanted ceiling, and with a bed frame and a bed. The walls were plaster and paper rather than stone. But he was locked in there. He was only allowed out twice a day to go to the bathroom, and he never set foot outside the house. That prohibition wasn't that bad, actually, because if he could go outside, Harry would put on the cloak and attempt to escape, and he was sure that someone would find him, and then they would take the cloak, and there would be trouble. So he could stay inside and think of a better plan to go find Remus. That was no problem. But they were not giving him much to eat, and Harry was hungry. Harry didn't remember even being hungry in the Blue Cottage. He remembered falling ravenously over food after a long day playing outside, but to him, real hunger came with a feeling of desolation, of being terribly small and alone and confused by the world. He kept thinking about apples, sweet but with a tart accent. Harry started to get some weird thoughts. He had a room, he had a bed, he had a few books, but none of the school ones, because Vernon had locked his trunk in the cupboard under the stairs. Better the trunk than him, that was for sure. Although he was locked, too, only now he had space to stand and stretch. The wallpaper was yellow. Sometimes the corners were an ugly green. He could go to the bathroom, he could wash. If he sat on the floor of his room, he could get the sun on his face, or his chest, or his legs. He could not get the sun over all of his body at the same time. Was this like Remus felt, too? The days blended together like a bag of gummy bears left under the sun. That had happened to him once. Harry wasn't getting much sun, but he wasn't hungry anymore, just a little bit tired. The gummy bears were different colors, and the days were different colors, too. Most were yellow, but there was green and red. This made sense. It was boring, and he was tired, but he wasn't hungry anymore. He wasn't anything. He was not feeling very much. Had he been talking to someone? He had the impression that he had talked to someone, but that couldn't be because he was locked in the room. Twice a day he could leave, and Petunia brought him food in the morning and evening, but she didn't really talk to him.
Harry Potter must not return to Hogwarts!
Oh, I wish. But they will come looking and people will get hurt. They took him and they may take someone else if I don't come back.
Harry Potter is in danger!
Give me danger, little stranger, answered Harry. Which was hilarious, because Dob was very little. He chuckled. And I'll give you a piece. How did the song go again? There's nothing in my dreams, just some ugly memories. Well, wasn't that right? He wished he could listen to the song again. All of his things were back at the Blue Cottage. Everything else the Ministry had given to him, or Hagrid bought it in Diagon Alley. But those weren't really his things. He wished he could have his books back, and his colored pencils, and his Walkman. There was an apple, yellow and red, colors mixed and blended like the days, like Harry's mind, resting on top of his pillow. There was an apple. Harry bit it, sitting on his bed. It wasn't that perfect blend of sweet and tart, but it was good, and something in Harry awoke, starting with a painful emptiness in his stomach, ouch, but also a sudden cutting awareness in his brain, as if he had spent the last few weeks without glasses, and now he had them back, and he was able to see again. He ate the apple, core and all, and hid the stem and the seeds in his pocket so Aunt Petunia wouldn't find them. He had talked to someone, hadn't he? He was quite certain that he did not have his Walkman during the last year, yet he could see it now on top of a chair together with a few cassette tapes and a couple of books, proper books. The color of the walls changed. Harry kept finding apples in the most unexpected corners of the room. Harry got letters from both Ron and Hermione. They asked why he hadn't answered, and Harry couldn't remember getting any others before. Unfortunately, the owls left immediately, so he couldn't attach an answer to them. He wasn't sure how much an owl could carry, but he remembered that Malfoy used to get pastries almost every day of school. Maybe they could send him a basket with a few cans of soup. Finally, there were more letters, and this time Harry had his answer prepared for the owl to take back. 2 days later, Ron was knocking on his window and waving a hand holding a wrapped sandwich. He was waving from a car, a flying car that Fred or possibly George Weasley was driving.
"Madeline's beard, you were right," said Ron. "Not that I don't believe you, but here, just eat this."
He shoved the sandwich in Harry's hands, and Harry ate slowly, sitting cross-legged on his bed, looking at Ron and Fred as they picked the locks and got his trunk and put everything in the car. Harry could feel himself waking. The sandwich was very good, and neither the cheese nor the bread had any mold on it. They glided away from the house, slowly and as silently as possible. They hovered a few centimeters over the road by the number 8, where they picked up George.
"Oh, wow,"
he said as soon as he saw Harry. He shook himself and thankfully recovered quickly from the lack of shock of whatever was so surprising at Harry's current appearance. "Street's clear. Saw no wizards around," he said, putting on the seatbelt. And with that, Fred pressed the pedal and they were in the clouds. Molly Weasley was a gift to humanity. Harry wondered what Remus would think of her. She yelled at Ron, Fred, and George for being irresponsible and 100 other transgressions. Then she looked at Harry, and her face did something weird, as if she couldn't decide on an expression, and proceeded to give Harry a smothering hug, his glasses crooked and jabbing him at the bridge of his nose. It was a wonderful hug. She kept yelling at her children throughout it, but the hug was awesome. Then she made them all sit down and gave them breakfast. Harry got a look at himself after that in the bathroom mirror. He was a bit pale, so the shadows under his eyes were more pronounced, and maybe his cheeks were a bit sunken, but that was to be expected. He hadn't cut his hair since before, so he was even more disheveled than usual. He looked terrible, but Harry didn't see it because he looked close to how he felt. The good thing about children, and Harry in particular, is that they bounce back. If you give them space and food and hugs, they bounce back. Harry got better skin color and the shadows under his eyes receded. There was so much to do in the burrow that he had no trouble at all falling asleep. He gained the lost weight back. And then there was the news, delivered to him and Ron at the same time by Fred and George, because the twins had no shame about eavesdropping. The news, it turned out, overlapped nicely with the plan being the project Hermione had been working on all summer. One day, Hermione was going to be queen of the world. He was sure of it. She had started to research magical law all by herself, because she found the lack of information about Remus's detention, trial, and imprisonment dubious, to say the least. There hadn't been much luck in that respect, but she had found instead that Harry was in some sort of limbo in which no one had custody over him. In fact, a man by the name of Sirius Black was supposed to be Harry's legal guardian. Guardianship Black hadn't gotten to exercise because he was, big shock here, in Azkaban. The only other alternative was his next of kin, Petunia in this case, but because she was a muggle and she hadn't filed for a standard recognition of knowledgeable muggle status, wizarding law didn't really recognize her authority.
"So I don't have a legal guardian?" asked Harry in between lazy bites of a piece of licorice.
"No, you do," said Hermione, having come to visit them at the burrow.
"A jail sentence doesn't strip you of possessions or legal authority, it's just that this man can't do anything about it."
That made no sense.
"So, can I leave?" "Well, the law is very unclear about it, and there are not that many precedents. Attendance to Hogwarts is not mandatory."
Harry poked up at that, but Hermione went on.
"But they require parental consent, and since you can't get one, I think the state, in this case the Ministry of Magic, is acting as your conservator."
"What Marnie means to say,"
Ron intervened, chewing on a sandwich. Harry now found himself surrounded by more food than he could possibly eat, but Ron was always happy to help,
"is that you can be adopted."
That was the unforeseen consequence of the plan. Someone could simply file a petition to foster Harry, although it wasn't as simple as that, since Hermione had quickly discovered that Muggle families were automatically rejected even when they had a brilliant and talented young witch in the house. Mrs. Granger had a few things to say about the Ministry's letter. Neither she nor Mr. Granger were familiar with the concept of rejection. And before Harry asked, Hagrid couldn't file either because he hadn't completed his Hogwarts education, and, to quote Ron's brother Bill, the ministry would sooner have a convicted Death Eater take care of Harry than give that kind of responsibility to a half-giant. The plan was facing a bit of trouble. Here's where the news came in. Ron's parents had decided to adopt Harry, and were now discussing how to ask Harry his opinion about it.
"I knew it! From the moment Mum knitted you a Christmas sweater, I knew it," said Fred.
"You know what this means?" George had a positively devious grin.
"It won't hurt at all," Fred smirked, followed by a small cackle. "We tried it with Lee last year. Just stay still and don't move."
George was drawing his wand.
"Please don't."
Actually, the Weasley family had more of an orange shade to their hair, with the exception of Charlie and Ginny, who had a brownish hue. The twins forewent this very sensible observation and turned Harry's raven locks into the reddest hair to ever red. Bill Weasley, who was spending some days with the family before going back to Egypt, hurt himself laughing. It was actually kind of nice. He reminded Harry of Eddie in a way, though Bill was very different with his long hair and earring and fang pendant. He immediately put his arm over Harry's shoulders and refused to let his mother change his hair back, and he gave Harry a hair tie. Muggle technology didn't work in magical households. Everybody knew that. Harry was pretty sure his had been a magical household. Levitating furniture and sudden glass glazing and wallpaper redecoration all seemed like qualifying magical events, yet they also had a functioning fridge, coffee maker, TV, and VHS, and Harry had his Walkman. He walked with Ron to the neighboring Muggle town to buy batteries. His hair had lost a bit of the vibrant red now and was slowly working its way back to black through a reddish brown. Ron's parents were going to adopt him. The world was a nice place. Harry got them both an ice cream. Harry's ice cream was lemon, his favorite. Ron's was strawberry, and for some reason he was embarrassed that this was his favorite flavor. Harry thought that it was stupid, and strawberry was a perfectly nice flavor for ice cream and any kind of treat, really. But he still swore not to tell anyone ever. It was an easy vow to make. The Walkman worked. Ron liked the Clash and refused to admit he also liked the Disney songs. He was intrigued by Queen. They went through most of the tapes during the next few days, walking to the fields beyond the house until they were far enough that the device was able to pick up Muggle radio. They would lie on the grass under the sun, sharing earbuds and music. Sometimes they looked at the clouds, but mostly Harry liked looking at the burrow from afar, with its hundreds of little additions and its appearance of being permanently in motion. He liked listening to music and looking at the house that had welcomed him. The tips of Harry's hair still had a bit of red when they took their trip to London and Diagon Alley. Harry did not enjoy that trip. He hated the place and the shops in a visceral way that felt like a hand closing into a fist in his stomach. And they saw the Malfoys, and Draco's dad was such an unbearable snob, looking at the Weasleys over his shoulder like that. He disliked the trip because it also meant returning to Hogwarts, and Harry had been so happy, so content living at the Burrow. Sleep abandoned Harry again, and he found himself lying awake at night counting, instead of sheep, the number of days since he last saw his dad. They returned to Hogwarts. Harry had the protection of the Weasleys' generosity to help him through the year. Ron hadn't been very interested in Harry's books. He just didn't see the appeal of a situation where things couldn't be solved by magic in the same way that he didn't understand how Dean could still be a fan of football when Quidditch was a sport that existed. But he had liked the music, some of it at least. And Dean Thomas hadn't thought about it, but once it was mentioned, he realized that he missed Muggle music, too. This is how the Walkman project started. They were not giving it all their time and energy, but it became something to think about during History of Magic class. How to make Muggle technology work in school.
"I said,"
Harry repeated in a slightly louder voice. To his right, Ron was staring at him with a mixed expression of horror and delight. Dean, who sat on the row before him, had turned around completely on his seat to look at Harry's face better. Seamus was looking straight ahead so as not to miss the teacher's expression. He was clutching Dean's hands in excitement.
"That I am not your bloody puppet!"
The smile on Gilderoy Lockhart's face froze as his mind attempted the insurmountable task of understanding rejection. He failed, of course he did, and went through the more familiar route of reconfiguring the world to better suit his tastes.
"No, Harry, dear. You will just stand here and pretend that you are the Wagga Wagga Werewolf, so I can represent how I defeated it."
All the girls in the class were angry with Harry. Ron's guffaws gained him some ill will, too, but everyone else thought his answer was great, and he didn't even lose any points. So surprised was Lockhart that he didn't manage to get another word in. Not even the twins had ever sassed someone like that.
"A werewolf is not an it,"
Harry had said.
If you had something more than gas in your head, you would know that, you sickening plague sore!
Harry wasn't friends with Mrs. Norris, because Mrs. Norris liked no one and only just tolerated Filch. But they had reached an agreement by which if Harry spotted Mrs. Norris during the day and they were alone, she allowed him to pet her. And if she encountered Harry at night, she gave him a decent head start before going to warn Filch, in exchange for a sardines can. Only Harry wasn't always carrying a sardines can, and sometimes he did, and it was daylight, but he gave it to her anyway. So their agreement was a bit shaky. Harry was very upset when Mrs. Norris was petrified. There was no reason for Filch to accuse him like that. Minerva McGonagall's heart trembled, a quick constriction of the muscle in her chest. Filch cried about his stupid, nasty cat, who always tried to scratch Minerva when she was in cat form, and then said they were attacking him for being a squib and accused Potter. Potter. And for a second it was not Harry, James and Lily's son in her office. It was James himself, with a bewildered and amused expression. James, who was good at Quidditch and Transfiguration, and easily Minerva's favorite student despite herself, because she knew he was trouble under his charming facade. Or maybe he was her favorite because of it. Harry had looked so hilariously offended, ready to fight for his almost squib status. Minerva had given him a piece of licorice and sent him on his way. Harry kept his nocturnal walks even after the first attack. He hated the school during the day, but at night the castle was quieter, and he just found it soothing walking through it like a ghost. A few times he saw the twins sneaking around, too. One time he saw Ginny, and another he found Malfoy in one of the high balconies of the towers. It was very tempting to throw something at him, but for once Malfoy was alone and silent, and Harry thought Draco had gone as far away as he could from the castle's dungeons. He was just leaning on the sill and staring out, so he let him be. During these walks, he took the Walkman with him. He still hadn't managed to make it work, and it was absurd to keep trying, but he did. A couple of times he heard some whispers and thought maybe he was picking up some radio station, but he never got them in the same place. Also, he heard the whispers during the day with no Walkman, so he wasn't sure what to think. School was slightly better this year. The novelty had worn off, and people didn't pester Harry as much with the whole being the savior of the wizarding world or the poor basement kid kidnapped by a monster. It had decreased to barely twice a day, which made it quite tolerable, really. He still kept forgetting his wand and could barely get any charm right. He was only just passing potions because he had always liked the subject, even if Severus had to treat him coldly and ended up taking some points during class. Sometimes he would manage to get detention with him, and Harry would spend a couple of hours drinking tea and eating biscuits, perusing Severus's most advanced books in his office. Those times were great. "The Weasleys offered to adopt me," he told Severus. "I think they would still want me to come to Hogwarts, but at least I wouldn't be at the Dursleys anymore." Severus drank a bit of his tea before answering. "They are very good people," he said. "Very loyal to Dumbledore." "Ah." The problem with Severus was that after the revelation that Voldemort wasn't as dead as everyone had thought him to be, he had become extra cautious. He wanted Harry out of Hogwarts, but he also wanted him where he could see him at all times. He was less eager to help Harry escape, and at the same time his animosity towards everyone had increased. No one was good enough to take care of Harry.
"If Remus got out of prison..."
"Harry, no one has ever escaped from Azkaban in all its history."
"But if it happened..."
"I would send you with Remus immediately, yes. You could hide in my house, and I know he would protect you."
"Good."
No one had ever survived a killing curse, and yet here was Harry. Remus could escape the unbreakable prison. Transfiguration was a complete disaster. The only good point of the class was that Neville was equally bad at it, so at least they were never singled out for failing an assignment. Hermione tried to help him with little success, and Harry told her to stop bothering. At least when she helped him in charms, he got better about 50% of the time. The funny thing was that Harry had never had trouble with certain magic, but when McGonagall gave them some balls of yarn and told them to change their colors, Harry couldn't do it. He only managed a strange lime green instead of the rich purple McGonagall had requested. And the day they had to transform a mouse into a candlestick, Harry put his wand back in his bag and spent the whole hour staring at the ceiling. He was not allowed to sit near a window anymore, petting the mouse in his hands. He got detention for that, even though he hardly got any detention lately. She made him come to her office on Thursday evening and told him he would not leave until he got the transformation right. At 10 that evening, she had to accompany him back to the tower and told him she would see him the next day. Harry wondered why she did that to herself, because she had looked so tired. even more tired than Harry himself. A few strands of hair coming loose and her red eyes rimmed. The mouse, of course, had not seen any transformation from Harry's hand. McGonagall angry was something that gave pause even to the twins, and they were fearless. So the next day, Harry remembered to bring his wand and drew it out without prompting and tapped the mouse with it, and of course, absolutely nothing happened. Nothing on Thursday and nothing on Friday and nothing for half the afternoon on Saturday until McGonagall released him so he could go to Quidditch practice and then she pretended to forget all about it. Harry was glad because he didn't think Candlestick's lives were particularly enjoyable, not for a mouse at least. A fork, maybe. A fork would be all right with being turned into a candlestick, but not a poor innocent mouse. Detention with Severus was good, even if they couldn't have it as often as Harry would like. When Severus helped him with his wand work, it was suddenly easier, and he had also started smuggling Muggle books for Harry.
"How did the VHS work at home?" asked Harry. "Everyone says it couldn't work in a magical house, but it did."
"It took me the better part of a whole bloody day to set it up," Severus snarled back in retrospective frustration. "You need to reverse Repello Muggletum and cart it in a sphere that surrounds the device, but at the same time make sure this spell doesn't interact with any other charms that are layering the house." Harry understood enough to know his ignorance.
"But then, how can you move it?"
"You can't. The setting is very delicate, and for the whole thing to work, there has to be a perfect balance. Otherwise, the protective Repello will give in, and the device will stop working." Harry drank a bit more of his tisane. Severus had stopped giving him tea because he was worried by the shadows under Harry's eyes, so now it was soothing herbal infusions, absolutely caffeine-free. Instead of sugar, he put a spoonful of some white honey from an almost empty jar.
"But I used my Walkman all the time, everywhere."
Severus chuckled. It was something rarely seen, and Harry had been witness to most of his laughs.
"Believe me, we were both surprised. You were only supposed to use it when we took you on excursions."
"But it couldn't have been me,"
Harry argued, although with no heat. Severus's designs took all the hot anger and left only calm warmth.
"I'm not good with magic."
"Harry, you're a wizard, and you are good at magic."
Severus spoke as if it were an obvious fact, like Harry needing glasses or the uncombable nature of his hair.
"To let it McGonagall, or Flitwick, or Sinistra, or, well, Lockhart had no grounds to complain."
"You are a bad student," Severus went on, "and that is not entirely your fault. You are good in potions, even if you tend to get distracted and need extra time. It's just that I have to measure everything twice because I'll forget that I'd already done it, or what step I was on," Harry explained. "It would be easier if I could listen to some music."
"And how is Herbology?"
Harry shrugged.
"It's fine, just it feels disconnected, you know? Sprout doesn't tell us anything interesting. We tend the plants, but we don't know what they mean or their use, and then we use them here in potions, and no one tells us how they got here, if they're to be dried or boiled or what."
Severus pondered this, biting his lip, and made a note to revise the curriculum when he had time.
"Ha!"
Harry left his office with a new book secreted under his robes. Sometimes, when Harry sung to himself, a soft instrumental accompaniment could be heard, like a small cloud of notes surrounding him, but lately he hadn't felt much like singing, so no one discovered this. Quirinus Quirrell could count himself lucky at having died in the vault, because Severus had already picked the painful poison that would give him an excruciatingly slow death, and he had planned how he would sneak into the infirmary to administer it, and even where to dump the body. But he had died, and Severus didn't have to do any of that. He only kept the sneaking part so he could visit Harry and reassure himself that he was all right, he was fine, he was alive and breathing slowly and deeply, his brave little boy. He still had the poison with him. He could give it to Lockhart. He could stand over him as the pompous imbecile writhed on the floor, sweating blood. And Severus could kneel by his side and oh so softly ask,
"Are you sure, Gilderoy? Are you absolutely sure that you found out the way to clean a nest of stingy bus snaps?"
And then Severus would hit him with a rolled-up copy of Magical Review, and he would force-feed him the article in which Remus explained how to do just that.
"Ah, you look cheerful today, my dear Severus. The spirit of the holiday is affecting you, huh?"
Severus stared at the buffoon. He could grab one of the garishly decorated pink cupcakes and smother him with it, Madame Hooch was looking at him and mouthing,
"Do it."
"Just you all know," said Martina Lesiak, current Slytherin head girl, to the gathered students in the common room, "Professor Snape says love potions are immoral, and their use is equal to rape, and he will personally poison any fool who tries to use one. Special mention to McNair."
"Did he not say that?"
cried McNair, the eldest, seventh year. Lesiak turned around the piece of parchment she was reading from for the room to see. McNair's name was capitalized and underlined.
"Damn, and I was hoping that he would kill that Lockhart fool himself,"
bemoaned Tsuruchi Tsubata.
"He's getting soft." "He's agreed to participate in the duel club," said Marcus Flint. "Maybe he'll hit him with a bolting curse."
"Anyway,"
continued Martina Lesiak, "he says that if you have to use a love potion, and you're incapable of convincing and or seducing someone, you are no better than a rejected Durmstrang student and a shame to all Slytherins." Harry didn't understand why everybody, even Ron, come on, was freaking out like that. The whispers returned with full force, and everybody was acting as if Harry had loosened his jaws and eaten a student's head in a single bite. All he had done was care for an animal. Harry liked animals. He was good with them. That poor snake was probably just frightened, and he had managed to calm her down. It is not easy to come to life suddenly and violently, and already an adult, and in the middle of a room of screaming people. They should be focusing on the madman attacking students, not on the schoolboy good with animals. Jeez. If Severus weren't afraid of what he could reveal in a state of inebriation, he would go find a pub and get completely plastered. Or maybe he would go to the lounge and drink one of their expensive bottles all by himself and then fuck a girl and a boy. It seemed like the kind of thing you do when you want to be outside yourself. But he couldn't afford to do any of that, and it didn't sound very pleasant in any case. All he did was pop to Spinner's End and listen to Stairway to Heaven on repeat for the whole length of Saturday. Harry was a parcel mouth. Harry could do something that the Dark Lord could do too. Severus had been right, where before he had only had suspicions and guesses. He had been right even though he still didn't understand the whole plan. He had nothing, really, other than the knowledge that Dumbledore's proclamations of caring for Harry's safety conflicted with his desire to destroy Voldemort forever. He had the intuition that there would be more demands piled over Harry, and he had such narrow shoulders. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord. Maybe all those dark wizards have been right, and Harry would have a power over the dark arts to rival Voldemort's, a weapon to be groomed and released at the right moment. Or maybe it was something else, a sort of connection. He had lived when others had died. He had lived, and so had Voldemort. Neither can live while the other survives. Lily had been made of light. A world without Harry would be darker no matter what. Voldemort was nothing but the vomit of the cesspool that was the wizarding world. If he was taken down, in 50 years there would be someone just like him stepping in. It wasn't about the man, it was about the society that produced him. In between all this, Severus only missed Remus for an hour and a half. He did not allow himself to miss him for longer than that each week. The Hufflepuffs were whispering and throwing Harry nasty looks after Justin's accident. Everybody was doing that, but the Hufflepuffs were more obvious about it. Ron picked a fight to defend Harry's honor, and he got detention. But Ron was quickly starting to care less and less about detention. He said he was acquiring quite a lot of skills, actually, that he hoped they would serve him one day, just as the twins' muggle lockpicking had come in handy. The most popular punishment was cleaning something by hand, and Ron was becoming quite adept at smuggling his wand and applying cleaning charms undetected, non-verbally and with minimal wand movement. The twins took it all as a joke, and Harry wasn't laughing exactly, but it was nice to see that someone could.
"So we reckon that Draco's behind all this?" said Harry,
blowing on the still hot tisane. He was sitting on the counter, his heels softly knocking against a keyboard.
"He isn't," said Severus over the table of ingredients. By the smell, he was brewing something similar to Wolfsbane, or possibly a Wolfsbane variation, which was strange.
"But he's strutting around, and the sign said the heir of Slytherin."
"Harry, I assure you that Draco Malfoy is not the heir of Slytherin."
"How do you know?"
Severus finished cutting the aconite with his scalpel before leaning back and looking at Harry directly.
"I know."
"That's not an answer."
"Harry, eat a biscuit."
Harry ate a dinosaur-shaped biscuit, but he kept staring at Severus, who ignored him for the next 15 minutes.
"You absolutely cannot tell.
anyone. Not Miss Granger, not Mr. Weasley, and certainly not Malfoy, understand? Very few people know this, and if you were to advertise it, it could easily be traced back to me. Harry nodded his head seriously. He could keep a secret, as evidenced by the fact that everyone thought Snape and he hated each other. Even if it was such a magnificent, juicy secret, something glorious that Harry felt should be proclaimed from the astronomy tower, not a word. But does he know? Draco, I really can't say. It is not something that Lucius admits easily. So the Malfoys weren't as pure-blooded as they liked people to believe. The Malfoys had, in fact, married a few half-bloods and even the occasional ambitious muggle. Lucius Malfoy had a third cousin who was a muggle, not a squib, but the son of one. He was in politics, unsurprisingly. It was such a magnificent secret that Harry completely forgot to ask again how Severus could know. Severus had gotten him the Count of Monte Cristo. Harry took the covers out of the book and very, very carefully divided it into more manageable packages of 100 pages or so. That way he could put the pages inside the History of Magic book, and it would look like he was paying attention in a class where no one, not even Hermione, could keep focus for long. He was only going to do it in that class, and maybe Defense Against the Dark Arts, because he wouldn't be missing anything important, what with Lockhart talking exclusively of his adventures. It was 2 hours during which Harry could be somewhere else and let his mind wander as much as he wanted. But then everyone was acting as if he spent his free time murdering people. The Hufflepuffs avoided him as if he were contagious. People said he had been wild last year, that he had gotten his bloodthirst from Remus, that Lord Voldemort, not a lord for God's sake, had only targeted him because he knew Harry was going to be even worse. And whenever Harry tried to give this the answer it deserved, McGonagall punished him and the nearest Gryffindor. So, of course, reading about Edmund Dantes preparing to wreck everyone was way more tempting than paying attention to his surroundings. Harry completely abandoned all the classes that required some sort of wand work and spent his time reading. Physically in class, yes, but reading. Sometimes he scribbled something in a diary he had found to keep the illusion that he was paying attention. The diary answered back, which as far as Harry knew was perfectly normal behavior for magical stationery. There was a singing hat that made much less sense. And then they lost Hermione. Most people stopped thinking Harry was behind the monster, but he didn't care about what they thought. He only cared about his friend, lying on a bed in the infirmary.
"The mass of the transformed object remains the same through the spell," Harry scribbled. "What? No. Equal mass and density facilitate the transfiguration, but they don't limit it." "Nobody asked you, Tom,"
wrote Harry with deliberate good handwriting, which was equivalent to careful and slow enunciation in his mind, like Severus did when he was dismissing someone or pointing out their stupidity.
"You should ask me. Transfiguration is a very delicate matter, and are you writing on top of my words?" "Stop it. Stop it! You stop it, or I'll fill this diary with drawings of dicks. You wouldn't dare. Try me. You wouldn't dare. You use words like folly and loathsome. You would not engage in such childish displays. Just don't give me a reason to. Write, write, write. Look at how I write in class. I'm taking notes. You could take real notes. You are blessed with no ears, Tom. Otherwise you would know the pointlessness of this class. Is it D.A.D.A. again? He is telling us about how he defeated a banshee in a song contest. I don't think that's possible. That's enough note-taking for me. I'm going to read for a while. Talk to you later. I think Eugenie is a lesbian. Who's Eugenie? Is that Ginny? She's Danglars' daughter. What house is she in? None. She's from the book I told you about.
Harry scratched his forehead as he reread the quickly vanishing lines.
Wait, do you know Ginny?
Harry was a selfish idiot, and he would never forgive himself for not acting earlier. He had noticed that Ginny wasn't particularly happy in Hogwarts, but he hadn't drawn the connection, or if he had, he hadn't thought it significant, and now she had gone missing together with the stupid, sassy diary. Of course, it could be argued that Harry, not being 13 yet, had no business worrying about these matters, and it was not his responsibility, but Harry would argue back and say that, with Hermione petrified in the infirmary, the role of sensible person obviously fell to him. He was so sensible, in fact, that he even thought of bringing adult supervision to their search and rescue party. He would much rather have Severus with him, but he understood it couldn't be. It would look really weird if he went to ask for his help rather than the head of his house. Lockhart was the DADA teacher, after all, he would do. McGonagall would have no grounds to be as angry as last year. The point of adult supervision was to have them be there and supervise. No one expected him to do anything beyond maybe reaching for something high. And now look at what he had done. Ron was injured, and he had broken his wand, and now Lockhart was the one who needed supervision. Harry offered Ron his wand, but he said that he would be fine with Lockhart's, so in Harry went, armed with a silly stick that sometimes shot sparks, and a rock he had taken from the small cave-in, to the lair of the monster. Once it became evident that the pretty boy manifestation was behind Ginny and the attacks, Harry didn't lose any time killing it with extreme prejudice. The basilisk helped. The basilisk appreciated Harry's manners much more than Tom Marvolo's orders. Tom Marvolo. Harry was right, he was no lord. "What have you been eating?" Harry asked the basilisk. He had his eyes closed, so he didn't know what exactly he was petting, but there was something cold and scaly under his hand, and Harry would be damned if he let the opportunity to pet an animal pass. The basilisk had been eating rats and lizards, mostly. It seemed to be responsible for a pest-free Hogwarts.
"It must be lonely. Do you feel lonely?"
"What is lonely?"
"Lonely is when you wish you had someone else with you."
"Hungry?"
"No, lonely. You wish you had someone to talk to and be with, like the man of the diary, or Ginny, or me."
The basilisk pondered the question. It had been hatched from an egg laid by an old cock just before his death in a clear night with the full moon. It knew neither father nor mother. It required no mate.
"Not lonely."
"Oh, I'm very glad."
He really was. The thought of the poor creature roaming the tunnels and pipes for 1,000 years was quite sad.
"Are you bored?"
That was the obvious next question. "Does it get boring?"
"Boring."
"Boring is when you don't know if you're hungry or sleepy and you don't know what to do, but you wish you could do something."
"Ah, boring. Yes, it gets boring."
The basilisk sounded actually pretty chirpy right now, happy at its understanding.
"I am bored."
Sometimes, though, it was less bored. It could move through the pipes and listen to the goings-on of the school, but yes, when the other boy had come, it hadn't been boring. He showed it a different tunnel, and it got the opportunity to stretch. It was nice, and now he had done it again. Explaining that it was not okay to entertain yourself killing students was a bit hard. The basilisk only knew itself, and the three males would come to talk to him, plus Ginny. Everything else was prey. Harry tried to impress the point that it either stopped attacking students, or it would be killed pretty soon. That would be bad.
"Who comes to kill me?"
"I don't know, wizards."
"I kill them first. I eat them."
"No, no, no, see, you can't do that. There'll be many, and one may sneak up on you and hurt you."
"I kill them all."
Oh dear, this was not working.
But if you kill them all, everybody will go away. Then it'll become really boring."
"They will go?"
"Yes, all the children you like to listen to. We'll all go somewhere else. You'll hear nothing."
The basilisk thought about it. It didn't really understand what the humans said, but sometimes there was laughter, and that was nice. And near the winter solstice, there were songs. Songs were nice to listen to, even if it was just one human singing something to themselves. Songs made the mind go a pleasant feather white.
"I only kill half of them,"
it offered magnanimously.
"No, I think you kill no humans at all. But you can eat all the rats you want."
"They are tasty."
"I'm sure they are. I'm told all rodents are,"
Harry agreed, remembering his childhood conversations with Mrs. K. It was agreed that the basilisk could just go on as usual and didn't have to kill anyone unless they came to its chambers, which would be rude. It promised to ask anyway, in case it was Harry or a Harry-like human. The basilisk had enjoyed their chat.
"There's choir practice every Wednesday and Sunday evening. That's every 4 and 3 days, and they meet in the little room left of the Great Hall."
That was a magnificent parting gift. The basilisk was enormously pleased. The hearing for Harry's custody was scheduled for the end of June. It was a disaster. Harry felt sick. It ought to have been a pretty simple process where a judge and two acolytes reviewed the petition and asked Harry whether he wanted to go with the Weasleys or not. Hermione had made flashcards for everyone despite having been petrified until the week before. Instead, what they found was a hostile judge, an acolyte that was insane, and another one who was plainly bored. They proceeded to ask the Weasleys over every minute thing in their lives, scouring for evidence of their bad parenting. They brought up Arthur's muggle fascination, as if that was somehow bad, and the twins' numerous transgressions, that according to Hermione should not be a matter of public record since they happened in school. They even suspected Ginny's kidnapping, and Harry felt his stomach clench. He had destroyed the diary. Nobody knew it had been her. She had been possessed anyway by Voldemort. Ginny was completely innocent, Dumbledore agreed, but even so, nobody knew, not even that much. Why would they act as if Ginny was somehow to blame then? To top it all, the insane acolyte pointed at their financial trouble and accused them of wanting Harry just to get access to his inheritance. Harry would gladly give them everything in his parents' vault, just for the hug Mrs. Weasley gave him last summer. He didn't say any of that, though, because he had learned well enough how the ministry twisted his words. The court deliberated for less than 10 seconds and ruled against. "It's all right," Harry said quickly to Ron and Mrs. Weasley. "I appreciate it." At the very least, they had given Harry enough hope that he had managed to survive another year in school without going crazy. They gave him something to cling to. He swallowed, and his voice barely wavered. He was becoming quite good at pushing grief down. "Dumbledore is going to have another talk with the Dursleys. It'll be fine, really." And then, "Now, for the request for Harry Potter's fostering, number 18000254/M326, said the board acolyte, turning to a second pile of documents in front of her. "The court will now interview Mr. Lucius Malfoy." If they gave him to the Malfoys, Harry would kill himself. He knew a lot about poisons. He could do it. Maybe after killing them, too. No wonder they kept asking about Ginny. Whose diary had that been, huh? For all the gods' sake, Lucius Malfoy used to be a Death Eater. But it obviously didn't matter when you had hair as beautiful as his. He charmed the tribunal with his eloquence and assertions of wealth, thus proving he only had Harry's best interests at heart. Look at how the poor boy was behaving after being with a werewolf and then with muggles. He would benefit so much from the right environment, stability, education, all things Lucius Malfoy could provide, and that he now felt was his duty to offer to the unfortunate orphan. Harry had to excuse himself to go to the bathroom and throw up and maybe drown himself. He rinsed his mouth of the sink and splashed some cold water over his face, which did nothing to abate the pounding in his temples. In a minute he would start repeating to himself that he could survive it, like a mantra, until his brain believed it, just as he had done last summer. He looked at himself in the mirror. He did not look convinced. Standing behind him was Draco Malfoy, staring at Harry's reflection. Draco with his pale, pointy face, Draco who called Hermione a mudblood. They hadn't talked with Bill, the accomplished cursebreaker, or Charlie, the expert dragon carrier and athlete, or outstanding on every exam Percy, but they would now interview Draco. Harry wasn't above acknowledging the virtues of his enemies. Draco could be charming, he was polite and eloquent when he wanted to be, just as he had a way to hurt you with his words that no other Slytherin possessed. If there was ever a convenient time for Draco to debut with some mental disorder, this was definitely it. Harry couldn't believe it, but he did not question it either. He simply nodded and called himself lucky. Dumbledore strolled in soon after the case was settled. He had a few words with the tribunal by the water fountain and ensured that there would be no other cases requesting Harry's custody, which was a blessing, given that the court was completely mental. He also personally accompanied Harry to talk to the Dursleys and guaranteed that Harry would be treated appropriately during the summer. Harry felt himself start to sweat with relief when before he had barely been able to breathe and thought his heart might have stopped beating. Wonderful Dumbledore coming to his rescue. Hagrid was right. Dumbledore was the greatest man. What a pity was his messy brain, though, always with intrusive thoughts. Why would he now go and think of Lady Tremaine? Harry didn't even like Cinderella that much. He'd only watched it a couple of times because some brainless relative of Olivia gave her the film as a birthday present. Olivia lived for The Lion King and had the strangest crush on Scar. They often played stories in which Scar found redemption and his own kingdom. and yet he thought of her now, Lady Tremaine, sweetly assuring Cinderella she could go to the ball, as long as she finished her duties. And Cinderella believed her.
"What the hell possessed you to say that?"
Lucius had been perfectly calm and controlled as they exited the courthouse and went back to the manor. Now he roared.
"Draco Moschili, qu'est-ce qui t'a pris?"
asked his mother. He wished he could answer them, but he didn't know himself. He wished he could say he had been hit by a confundo. Granger or any of the Weasleys could have cast it. But Draco knew it wasn't true, because everything had felt perfectly clear and defined, as if it were more real than the rest of real life, if that made sense. Of course, silence wasn't an acceptable answer, and his father struck him across the cheek.
"Don't be quiet now. What the hell was that?"
What had it been?
I only told them the truth,
said Draco. This was true, too. He was being very honest today. He had just said that no, he would not particularly welcome Potter to his house, and he didn't think his father cared for or wanted him other than his political leverage.
Che domas, Draco? Si sui tredici? Maman, je ne sais pas ce que...
His father slapped him again. He had expected that. Not that he had planned for what would happen today, because he hadn't. But Draco knew he had earned it, and he was prepared to receive it. Draco was no coward. He was certainly not afraid of his father. He took whatever he gave him, and he received the beating with no word of protest, because he understood that it was well-deserved. Draco was a dutiful son. Afterwards, Lucius forbade Narcissa from casting any healing charms on Draco, said the sting would remind him the following days of his misbehavior. Draco had not expected that. But then again, he had never committed such a grave transgression. He had thought, naively perhaps, that this would be it. Father had administered his punishment. Draco would hurt for a few days. Normalcy would return as the black turns to blue, and then to yellow, and then to white. He hadn't considered that his father saw it, not like misbehavior, but as a betrayal. That once he had struck him like this, it was easy to do it again, for lesser reasons. That the bruises were a constant reminder of what Draco had done, and so Lucius punished him again. But it was all right. Draco was an only child in a big house. He was accustomed to solitude. Most days he only saw his parents during meals, and rarely for all of them. It was easy to make himself scarce for most of the time, and work to get his father's approval when he was in his presence. Once he looked like himself again, it would be even easier to be the son his father desired. Draco was a dutiful son, who had undergone a moment of madness. End of chapter 2. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 page as well as the Tumblr of author Andrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. If you would like to commission me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find the stories that I've read, as well as links to my Patreon page, to which I hope you will consider subscribing to support me, and my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.